I mean, seriously, we waited a month for that. Kevin Barker, maybe I'm overreacting a bit. One game. George Springer's return to the lineup. Maybe I'm overreacting a bit. Yeah, I admit I am overreacting a little bit. That was the story going into yesterday's game. George Springer returning to the Blue Jays lineup. In the end, though, the story of the game was the Washington Nationals. I wouldn't say they had their way with Steve Matz. They basically had, they won 8-2, and 8-2 is 8-2 is 8-2. But, Kevin, they had a bunch of balls just kind of fall in front of guys, behind guys, just off to the side of guys. Again, 8 runs is 8 runs, and I'm certainly not going to sugarcoat it. But in a lot of ways, that was, you'd almost say he got baseballed, right? You'd almost say he got baseballed last night.
If that means he's pitching backwards, yeah, I'm with you. He gave up 7 singles. He gave up 1 3-run homer. You know, normally you would take that if your offense is clicking on all cylinders. But you start digging into his numbers a little bit. He threw 80 pitches. He threw 32 fastballs.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about that. 32 sinkers. He threw an awful lot of off-speed pitches.
48.
Why?
That's a great question. Yeah, he had 2 different curveballs. He had a slower one. He had one that looked like a slider. His slider that he was trying to throw looked more like a cutter. His changeup normally has some good sink to it. It was a tick higher in velocity. It had a little bit more run to it. For whatever reason, whether it was his bullpen before the game, the sinker wasn't coming out of his hand right. I just say this. I know he gave up a couple of hits on his sinker, which is okay. But for him, for me, you have to establish the 90. It's 95, and he's left-handed, and it has sink to it. In on the righty, he can elevate it. He can start it on the black, and it end up in off the plate, which is a tough pitch for a right-handed hitter to take. And then you start expanding with all the curveballs and the changeups and that slider-cutter thing that he throws. I just, you know, the one time that Petey ran out there and said something to him, I was wondering what he might have said to him or what the conversation might have been like, because it was very quick. It might have been a mechanical thing, but you start digging into those numbers. Maybe you ran out there and said, hey, what are you doing? Throw your better pitches. Throw the old number one and then expand and get him to start trying to chase the other secondary pitches. Every once in a while, you just got to wonder, when you're walking away from a game like that where you only gave up 7 singles in the 8 hits that you gave up, did you get beat with your best stuff? There's no way he can walk away from that going, yes, I did.
Yeah, that, and I think Buck made that point during the telecast as well. I kind of feel a little guilty here because we did Sportsnet.ca, Ben Arden, Shine, myself. We did kind of a first month look at the Blue Jays, and one of the questions was, is what Steve Matz doing sustainable? And it just happened that question was being asked last night. Well, he was getting his he wasn't even getting his what's lit up, but. Barker mentioned 7 singles and a 3-run homer. But one of the things that does concern me, and I don't know if maybe we saw this last night, but we had Pete Walker on earlier this year. Pete Walker also did a Zoom availability earlier this year. And Steven Matz, Kevin, has said on a couple of occasions that one of the things he needs to do to be successful this year is be unpredictable. And watching that last night, I was thinking to myself, okay, it's great to say we're going to be unpredictable, but Bark, I don't know if I want to make 25 starts trying to outthink hitters. You know what I mean? Like, it's great to say we're unpredictable. We're going to try different stuff, et cetera, we're going to pitch different ways and all that good stuff. But man, if you've got stuff, shouldn't you just rely on that? Like, I get what Pete is saying, and I get what Steven is saying. I just don't know if you can sustain that all year.
Yeah, I think Petey was talking about after you establish your best pitch and then you're unpredictable with your secondary pitches. You know,
when you
throw a breaking ball, you know, he threw a lot of 0-0, a lot of 2-1 breaking balls last night. Those are fastball counts for him. You got a power sinker into a righty, throw it. I'm giving it bad. But Buck Martinez always talks about how you pitch to the bottom of the order differently than you pitch to the top of the order. Victor Robles hitting 9th, sitting around 200. 4th inning last night. Matz threw him 7 pitches, 2 curveballs, 4 changeups, and a sinker, and walked him. That's pitching. That's how you as a he's gotten off to a really good start because he's established his best pitch in the other starts. And for whatever reason last night, he wasn't pitching the way he was supposed to be pitching to certain parts of the lineup, which was for me very confusing. And again, we have no idea what goes on in bullpens and closed doors and how he was feeling and all of these things. You just know the fastball last night was still 95. He just, for me, didn't use it enough.
Yeah, I think that's it's probably a good description of what happened last night. And the question now with Steven Matz, and this is not rocket science. I mean, we've talked about this with a lot of the issues with Steven Matz, folks with the Mets and folks at the Blue Jays will tell you a lot of the issues with Steven Matz between the ears when it comes to the ability to be resilient, the ability to handle setbacks. And this is really kind of his first little bobble, right? This is his first little stumble as a member of the Blue Jays, and we'll see how he responds. We don't know yet how the starting rotation is set up. We believe it'll be Robbie against Atlanta. The Jays have today off. They got three games against Atlanta. We do believe it'll be Robbie Ray bullpen, and then maybe Ross Stripling. Matz would be on schedule to go Monday against Oakland in Oakland, and then. You know, we're hearing you may see Nate Pearson make an appearance on the fourth. I mean, the fact of the matter is we really don't know, but we'll see how Steven Matz reacts.
Don't be afraid to throw a little blame towards Danny Jansen either. Danny Jansen's caught all of his starts. Danny Jansen knows what it looks like when he's going really well. Raise your hand, run out there and go, hey man, you know what your best pitch is? Let's throw that. Yeah, especially when a guy behind the plate's hitting point something. These are games where when you're hitting the way you're hitting, you need to show up when it comes to the defensive side of it and putting the right fingers down. I'm not saying that wasn't the game plan, but you could tell early on that the game plan wasn't working. So you raise your hand, you run out there, you go, hey, that's not working. You have a good fastball. When we're throwing it, for the most part, the hitter's telling you that it's really good. Let's continue to throw it, and then we can start expanding with all of that other stuff and get on the same page here. Again, it's one of those things, Jeff, where you have to, at least in your starts, at least when you're feeling well, be able to walk away from the start saying that I got beat with my best stuff. I'll come back and get him the next time. He can't say that.
You made an interesting point about Victor Robles, because I think that at-bat in the fourth inning was the one that kind of got everything started. And yes, it's true, the ball four was questionable. But again, you're facing the number nine hitter.
Yeah.
If you want to get a strike, if you want to get out of there, Kevin, you got to bury a fastball.
You do. And again, you just do.
You can't be sticking around with curve or with off speed stuff to the number nine hitter in that count.
There you go.
Can't.
We've seen the umpires. You don't put the outcome of the at bat in the umpire's hands.
Correct.
Make a quality pitch early in a count with one of your better pitches, which is your fastball. Then it takes all the guesswork out of it for the umpire. Yeah, you know, I'm the first one to raise my hand and say the umpires, watch the games. They're not real good. But when it comes to certain people in certain parts of the lineup, especially when a guy like Victor is struggling and hitting something around 200, a 200 average doesn't lie most of the time. That will tell you normally he's having an issue with something hard. It's still the way it is now. You look at people that are struggling. They don't struggle because they're not hitting the breaking ball. They're struggling because they're not hitting the heater.
It's funny, you know, because I think it might have been Darren Fletcher who made the point one time that when you're catching a guy who isn't throwing a lot of fastballs, you have to be aware of the fact that you're also making it, it's not that you're making it difficult in the umpire, but sometimes you got to throw a fastball just to kind of draw the umpire's attention back to the middle of the plate, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to do that. If you're throwing off speed stuff and the ball's darting this way and that way and it's slow and it's coming over like this, I mean, you are dealing, I'm not making excuses for umpires here, but, you know, if you're at the end of an at bat where you've done nothing but throw off speed stuff or breaking stuff, you're more or less putting yourself in the hands of the umpire.
You're left-handed.
I don't know how you feel.
You're a left-hander who throws 95 with sink. Throw it. It's hard to hit.
So we'll see how he responds to this setback. As I said, it's been pretty smooth sailing for Steven Matz.
Yeah.
And the Vila was there last night, so we'll see. We'll see how he responds. All right, George Springer was in the lineup for the first time, leading off, DHing 0 for 4. You know, Kevin, we talked about it before we came in the air. Look to me, I think you said, look like a guy who hasn't played baseball since March.
Yeah, his last real game was against Garrett Cole, March 21st against the Yankees, obviously. He was 0 for 3. That's the last real action he's had from a real big league starting pitcher who can control something and expand with something else. You know, he looked exactly the way he's supposed to look. He was a little out in front of the curveball, the off-speed pitches. He was a little behind of the hard stuff. That's all you probably that's what you're going to get for the first couple of days. I will say it's pretty simple. You know, he sets his bat path real early. He picks the front leg up. He sets it down. He tries to attack the baseball. It's not going to take a ton of him for timing wise.
That's what I was
to get the barrel to baseball when that approach is so simple. And he's a veteran guy. He knows what it feels like when he's going well, and he'll take enough swings in the batting cage and know when to, you know, take a little off the pedal to understand that, you know, I need to go up and hunt a certain pitch to get myself hot. And the guy hitting behind him, the hotter he gets, the more quality strikes he will get to hit. Now, you're going to pitch him a certain way to get him out no matter what. The getting to that kind of pitch is not really going to change who's hitting around you. But if Bo gets super hot and starts driving the baseball out of the ballpark, it will get him quality strikes to hit. That means the ball catching a bunch of the plate, which will help him to get on track quicker. They need him. With where the rotation's at and as much as they're going to have to use the bullpen, the lineup now, we talked about this till we're blue in the face. The lineup now has to step up. They got to carry this team. We're going to have to stop talking about Kevin Biggio hitting fifth. I'm a fan of Kevin Biggio's. I'm okay with that. If he wants to play him third and hit him eighth or ninth, I'm good with that. But the hitting him in a spot where he's a run producer is just, even when you don't have Teoscar Hernandez, and I get bat paths and the guy throws sinker and a cutter and he don't like to elevate the baseball and you would think he gives him a little better chance. Let's not overthink this thing. Right now he's struggling. I know he's coming off a game where he got a couple hits. That to me doesn't really matter. I want to put my best run producers up front. And also you want to start getting guys into a certain routine of when Teoscar comes back, which it does look like he's coming back Friday. If you put Kevin in, say, the nine hole, which me and you've been beating at, we've been saying that that's a great spot for him because he can be Kevin, sort of that second leadoff guy. He can just go up and do what he wants to do. Being a run producer, Jeff, you know, you've talked to enough of them, is no joke. Your at-bats change. You probably get one swing at it to put some ball in play very hard. You know, ask Randall. Randall hitting cleanup's a little different than hitting sixth or seventh. You know, it's just for me, the lineup, they sometimes it'll make you wonder. It'll make you wonder.
Well, we know though, Kevin, that the lineup is set largely by analytics, and it's not just lefty righty; it's swing paths, things of that nature. We could sit here and talk about it, but that's just simply the way it is. And I just assume, I assume that people much smarter than me know what they're doing, and are playing the percentages. And are using best available data, but I'm with you from an eye test point of view. I want to give Kevin a little bit of breathing room. I know what he is as a hitter. I think we all know what he is as a hitter now. Well, maximize that. Turn that into a strength. How do you do that? Again, to me, you hit him ninth. Get a little bit of surprise power every now and then. There's nothing wrong with that.
Nope.
But let him get on base so that when George Springer comes up and Bo follows him, you've at least got the makings. You've got the makings of a big inning. Like, I'm excited by the idea of this lineup with Teoscar back and with a bottom third of Semien, whoever's catching, and Kevin Biggio. I think you can really go to town with a lineup.
It's long. It's harder to pitch to. It's harder to match up against. You're putting guys in positions to succeed as an individual. You're setting that guy up to help the guy in front of them. It for me makes a ton of sense. The run producing thing, I've said this to you forever. That's the one thing for me that the Blue Jays need to figure out, a guy that can produce runs, a guy that when that situation calls on, like last night when Randall come up with the bases loaded after they intentionally walked Vladdy and he swings at the cutter a little bit middle of the way, that for me is not a quality at bat. But can you blame Randall? Not really, because he's not a run producer. He's a home run hitter. He's a streaky home run hitter. But putting him in a cleanup spot with the bases loaded after they just intentionally walked a guy, probably telling you a little bit that we're going to take our chances with you because the guy in front of you is a lot better. It's just, it's a lot to ask these guys. This is what I'm saying. You know, it's time in the season right now, especially now that you're thinking that Teoscar's either coming back Friday or Saturday, probably one of them 2 days, that now it's time to let guys get into a flow and a routine of when I put my batting gloves on. I know these things sound simple, but when you know, Justin Smoke used to always tell me, and I used to ask, do you like hitting second? And he would yell at me and scream at me, no, because I have to run in, especially when we're playing at home, and hurry up and put my batting gloves on and my helmet on. I know it sounds silly to the normal baseball fan, but to the players it matters. So getting them into that routine as quick as you possibly can is only going to help them. And again, it gets back to the point, Jeff, is they're going to have to hit and hit a lot. They're going to have to win some 10-7 games real soon.
Right. Right. Well, especially given the health right now of the starting rotation. We'll talk about that later on in the show. We'll be joined by Mark Feinsand, executive columnist with MLB.com, in a few minutes and take a look around Major League Baseball. I also want to mention in this segment, because we spent a great deal of time talking about it since the weekend, second game in a row, Kevin Barker, where Bo Bichette looked like he was just completely carefree.
Yeah.
Completely without a ball hits him, doesn't have a care in the world.
Yeah, we heard John Snyder talk about the one-handed catches. The ball, obviously the backhand, you have to catch that with one hand. The couple that you're noticing is the ball that's hit right at you that's pretty hard, that has the skip. It hits the ground, it's skipping. A lot of times he wants to catch that two hands. The one that he has to run in on, he wants to bend down and catch it with two hands. You notice the last couple of games he hasn't done that. But basically what that does is it frees your feet up so your feet can get in the position towards the target where you want to throw it to a little bit easier and a little bit quicker. And the exchange from your glove to your hand is quicker. And that's his whole deal is, right? How many times you ever seen Bo get a ball with catch it with two hands, and it's that big windmill long turn with his arm, and the whole time he's doing that, the runner's making up ground to first base, and then he sees the runner, and he rushes it, and he chucks it in the ground, and everybody has to either pick it or he misses it kind of thing. It sounds like an easy fix. It sounds to me like, even when we were talking to John yesterday, he said, I'm actually looking at him right now doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So he understands that he needed to fix something, and I'm not saying that's going to fix the whole entire thing, but you saw yesterday, the ball that he picked in the third, in the shortstop hole, that he sort of jumped in the air and threw. I know Vladdy had to pick it, but the exchange, the confidence, the throw had a little bit more on it. And again, he had two hits. You know, you laugh at me.
You made that point.
Yeah,
you
laugh at me all the time about the
I don't laugh at you.
It carries over.
There's things I laugh at you laugh at you for, but not that.
Well, Bo is a big leaguer because he is an offensive player. And when you're doing what you got to call to the big leagues for, your other side of the ball tends to be a little bit better because you're freer and easier and you don't really care. To be honest with you, you're going out there, you don't really care. It's just hit to me, I'm going to catch it, I'm going to throw it where I should throw it. And you're starting to see a little bit more of that. So hopefully for the Blue Jays' sake, especially with all the things we just mentioned, the injuries and the balls are probably going to be put in play a little bit more. If Bo's going to play short, he's going to have to make the plays he should be making.
Yeah, that's – and again, we will address the starting rotation later on. But it is pretty apparent that the ball is going to be in play a great deal this year.
Yeah.
And guys are going to be – called upon to make plays, and you know what people say, and it is accurate. For whatever the reason is, the ball does seem to find you when you're in a funk. The ball does seem to find you. It's just one of those things. Before we break, wanted to ask you if you've ever lost a ground ball in the sun before, like Joe Panic.
I have, yes.
Tell us about that, because I know there are people saying, "Come on, it bounced. You can pick it up. You catch it." I watched Joe. Did you see Joe Panic's reaction? He was muttering about minor league stadium and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You could tell he was, isn't a major league stadium. Talk to us about that, because that's something I thought you would know.
Yeah, the first game I ever played in Wrigley Field. Field is famous for the short little, what is that, around the field, you know, where the sun is just barely above it. And it's every, like, ground ball that's on the right side that time of the day is real hard, especially the big hoppers. And I can remember a ground ball that I got early in my career. Now, again, I was, It's every play. You're trying to lay in front of that thing. And I had the flip downs because I could never wear the sunglasses because it was very hard for me, for whatever reason, to judge depth of the ground ball. And I wasn't real comfortable wearing them. So I'm wearing the flip downs, and the ball goes up in the air, and I'm trying to hit my hat bill and flip my glasses down. And I could just remember that when it went down, the ball was already in the outfield. It's just a helpless feeling that what are you going to do? You look over at your pitcher and you go, hey, look, there's nothing I can do. Normally if I see it, I can catch it. But it's one of those signs where you just can't see it. You can't catch it.
No. And in that situation, you can't shield your eyes or anything. I mean, that ball's coming off the bat. You're kind of in self-defense mode there too, aren't you? Cause you don't know where it's going.
Yeah. Well, I know I was trying to lay in front of it. I'd rather take a little high chopper off the chest and maybe knock it down in front of me. And then the pitcher can be covered and I can flip it to him. But if you're playing the left side of the infield, if it bounces off you, it's an error. Or it's a hit.
Was that when you were with the Brewers?
I was with the Brewers, yeah.
Your good friend Fernando Vina didn't rescue you.
No, that's the pop-ups. Where he looks at you, you got it. And then he just turns around, walks off, lets me try and catch it. Yeah.
I love that story. You got it. Then you just turn around and walk off. It's like Kevin Kiermaier and Randy Arozarena the other night. Kiermaier stepping in front of Arozarena and trying to make that throw.
Yeah,
but he
gets paid to catch fly balls. The pop-up in the infield is a little different than it is going in the outfield because of the wind and the way the ball comes down. And it's not something you practice. We practice that all the time in spring training. But when the regular season starts and you got fans and, you got the little – every obviously field is different. The foul territory and you're running all over the place. Then your second baseman basically hands you out to dry because he doesn't want to catch it. Yeah, I'd rather let the rookie look like he's
over. That's a veteran move, Barker.
Let the rookie look like an idiot.
Okay. Hey, this is interesting. Travis McKenzie, my producer, just reporting the Blue Jays have announced that they're moving back all Dunedin weeknight starts from 7:07 to 7:37.
There it is.
Travis says, though there's been no official reasoning given for the change,
it seems like it's
to combat the sun glare issues at third base and in left field early in games. I mean, we've seen that camera shot of Lourdes Gurriel Jr. He looks like his retina's being burned out.
That's it. And sunglasses doesn't matter. With the glare and as bright as it is right on your sunglasses, you're trying to use your glove to shield that and catch pop-ups. It's just not a great feel. Good for them. They saw a weakness. They're trying to help out their team as much as they can in a bad situation. Good for the Blue Jays.
You know, and let's be clear. I mean, they're on the field first. Right? Yeah. They're on the field first to start the game, so it's more of an issue for them. And I've also got to think, I don't think anybody would complain about it. Like, it really doesn't matter what the other teams think, 7:07, 7:37. No. I'm sure it doesn't make a difference. But, this is, I give the Jays credit here because they're listening to their players. You know as well as I do, guys saw what happened and somebody said something to somebody.
Yeah, and that may have a little something to do, too. They noticed that pitching. Boy, I don't know about that pitching. We're going to have to catch every single ball that we're supposed to catch. We may be backing those times up. So everybody, you see the ball, catch it.
We back it up a couple of days. Maybe we can have Hyun-Jin Ryu start every game if we figure out how to do this. Mark Feinsand is the executive reporter with MLB.com. We'll take a look around the majors. I was just thinking of Fernando Vina again. It's a long story, folks. Someday we'll tell you it on the air. It's Baseball Central at Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, poor Jacob DeGrom. Guy's got an ERA of like
0.51.
.51.
Is that good?
That's been known to
giving up two earned runs all season.
Win you the Cy Young Award.
Both times he gave up one earned run in one game and one earned run in the other game. Both games they lost. Stay hot.
Yeah, and this most latest setback, of course, was last night to the Boston Red Sox, memorable because it appears as if Francisco Lindor was booed, which is going to happen in New York. It's going to happen and I think baseball fans are savvy enough, and I think especially now most baseball fans I think have a really good grasp of statistics and a really good grasp of just how good really good players are, if that makes sense. I think we understand what makes a player or a pitcher the very best in the business more than we ever have in the past. I think we're more comfortable having discussions about that, not just as fans, but also as media. So I think when people see a Jacob deGrom go out and lose 1-0, I think there is a tendency to get on the losing team or get on the team that, in this case, the Mets. And I think maybe with a deeper knowledge of why things are happening than we may have had in the past. Mark Feinsand is executive reporter with MLB.com. He's New York-based. He joins us on Baseball Central. Mark, as always, thank you for doing this. I trust that you're staying safe and keeping well. Look, we've talked a lot in this show about Jacob deGrom, and clearly everybody in baseball talks about Jacob deGrom. You know, I know you've compared him, the 2021 deGrom, to the 1919 Pedro Martinez. I mean, there are so many comparables to him, and those comparables are only going to grow. But I have to ask you, what do you think? Like, he's done a very good job of disguising, I think, anyhow, at least publicly, whatever frustration he's felt so far with the Mets. Is that just him? Is he putting on a good act, or is that really just Jacob deGrom?
I think that's really just deGrom, although I think we may have figured out why he cut his hair. When he had the long hair, I think he was too busy pulling it out after each one of these starts that he finally had to just cut it. I don't know how he holds himself together in post games and everything else when you keep losing these tough games. I mean, he has a 0.51 ERA, and the Mets are 2-3 in games he pitches. And that 0.51 skyrocketed last night after giving up a run because it was a 0.3 before that. Look, he is as good a pitcher as we have seen, I think, in 20 years since the peak Pedro Martinez. And before that, I mean, I think you're looking at guys like Gibson and Koufax for runs like this. I mean, DeGrom's performance over the past 3 to 4 years is approaching that Koufax 5-year run that's, you know, widely considered the greatest 5-year run any pitcher's ever had. Obviously, Koufax threw a lot more innings. You know, the pandemic season last year limited DeGrom to just 12 starts and 68 innings. But, you know, right now he's averaging 7 innings a start in a league where guys don't throw 7 innings anymore. And with 59 strikeouts and, 4 walks in 35 innings, he has mastered the craft like none other right now.
Okay, Francisco Lindor, it's a little different playing in the AL Central than, you know, being paid and going to the NL East. You know, this may be an unfair question to you because of what we're going through and the Zoom calls and those kind of things. But if anybody can answer this, you. Do you think mindset-wise that Lindor can handle being booed?
I think he can. I mean, again, just like you talked about DeGrom sort of saying the right things, Lindor was on a Zoom yesterday and he said all the right things. He said, look, I'm not performing to the level to which I'm accustomed and people are accustomed, and I get it. And, you know, hopefully when I do start producing the way that I'm supposed to, those boos will turn into cheers. And, I've been covering baseball in New York now for 2 decades. And I remember back to, you know, my first year or my second year covering the Yankees when Jason Giambi signed with them. And he started out slow and he was getting booed. Then he hit a grand slam and an extra inning game. And it was like, oh, the Giambino, we love him. So, you know, if Lindor turns things around and plays like Lindor, I don't think this is going to be a long-term issue. He's signed here for a long time, so I hope for his sake and for the Mets' sake that he can handle it. But all indications from being around him in the past and just talking to people, you know, who know him, are that this is not going to bother him. I reached out to somebody I know at the Mets, and I joked the other day. I said, "So you guys regret that Lindor contract yet?" And he laughed, obviously. And you know, I think we'll be okay. So I don't think there's any panic, but. You know, Met fans right now are looking at this team with great expectations, and they see themselves at 9-10. Fortunately, in a division where the two first-place teams are 12-12, And they just sort of think, why are we not better than this? And obviously, when you have a brand new $341 million contract, you're going to be one of the guys who they point to if you're not getting the job done.
Yeah, we talked about expectations. That other team, the Yankees, they're 6-4 in their last 10 games. Do you think they're out of their little mini slump? Or are they going to get back to being the big bad Yankees again?
I mean, I think they'll get back to being the big bad Yankees again offensively. I mean, I have to think that with the bats in that lineup that they will have better than a plus one run differential over the course of the season, which is where they are right now. My bigger concern with the Yankees, if I'm a New York fan or a member of that front office, is just the pitching staff. I mean, Corey Kluber finally looked like himself the other night. Garrett Cole's been fine. And some of the other guys have pitched okay, but they just haven't gotten consistency out of the rotation. They've had some bullpen injuries to deal with, like everybody else in baseball, it seems. I think the pitching is what the Yankees need to get straightened out over the long haul here, because they're going to hit. I mean, there's too much talent in that lineup for them not to.
You know, we've heard that Aníbal Sanchez is going to make a decision today on where he signs, or is at least close to making a decision. He's a free agent. We know that the Jays were one of the teams that saw him work out. Rick Porcello's still out there as well, Mark. There are teams that, let's face it, could use an upgrade at pitching. And I understand that a lot of teams take the approach, hey, we held spring training for a reason. We did our off-season lifting for a reason. We want to give these guys a run, see what we have, and then we'll pivot off that. But given the way so many teams seem to be, you know, scuffling right now, or not scuffling, but in need of another arm, do you see both of those guys going somewhere pretty soon? And I'll just ask you, is Porcello just not that good? Like, I think I know what he is, but I got to tell you, I've watched some guys pitch this year, and I keep thinking to myself, geez, I think Porcello could be at least as good, if not better than
them. Yeah, I think with Porcello, I mean, since his Cy Young season, he's carrying an ERA about 5 over 4 seasons. So he has not come close to matching that Cy Young form that he had in 2016. You know, he used to be one of those every other year guys for a little while. Now, the last 3 years, his ERA went from, you know, 4.2 to 5.5 to 5.6. And, you know, Aníbal Sanchez had a good little run in there. And then last year, his ERA was, you know, north of 6.5. So will these guys land jobs? Probably, only because, like you said, there are some really bad pitching out there and teams that have injuries and maybe don't have a big league ready guy. It's not going to take a ton of money to sign these guys, and you can always sign them. And if it doesn't work out, you cut bait, and it probably hasn't cost you a whole lot. So it's a pretty low risk and potentially, I don't want to say high reward, because I don't know that either of these guys at their age are going to be back to their peak form, but certainly a low risk and you know, decent reward return if they come back and can provide you any sort of consistency in the back end of a rotation.
Okay, Mark, I want you to do me a favor and give your grade on umpiring at the big league level. And if your grade is bad, how do you think you could adjust it to make it a little bit better?
I've never been one to sit here and play armchair quarterback with umpires.
Yeah.
Only because I've umped little league games before. Uh-huh. And those are brutal. And I can't imagine bumping up the speed to a big league game and still having to come up with some of those calls. The umpiring hasn't been great. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't know that robo umps are the answer. I mean, I think a consistent strike zone would be a nice thing, just in terms of like every ump calling the same strike zone, because now it seems like you look and you're like, well, this guy likes to call the high strike. This guy gives him a couple inches on the outside of the plate, you know? So pitchers need to know that and sort of adapt every game of, all right, what is this umpire calling? The strike zone should be the strike zone. And that's my one, you know, maybe where a robo ump situation could help out, where this is the strike zone and it's not a subjective thing. Here's what it is. Maybe that would be the one thing that I think could help out. But, you know, guys missing calls at first base or guys missing a call here or there, there is still a human element in this game and in this profession of umpiring. And I think considering how much could go even worse, that they do a pretty good job overall. The problem is that when there's a bad call that really impacts the game, obviously it gets magnified, you know, a whole lot more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's really well said. Look, and I mean, I try to tell people, I know that at some point I'm going to come around to the idea of the electronic strike zone. You're still going to have the human element, an umpire behind home plate, because he's still going to have to adjudicate the game. I know I'm going to come around to that. But, you know, the issues that really seem to set baseball fans off, Mark, it's not going to be solved by robo-umpires. You know, Marty Foster gets a play wrong at first base. That robo-umpire ain't solving that. unless you want to review every single play in baseball, and I don't even want to go there. I think people need to kind of step back a bit here and be a little realistic about what we are asking these guys to do. And
I agree.
I've always felt that way. And I know I feel like I'm pissing into the wind, right? Because nobody defends umpires, yada yada yada, et cetera, et cetera. But you're never going to get 100% certainty in this game. You're just not.
No, and it's just, you know, like you said, there's not going to be a way to robo-ump the entire game, right? You're just not going to be able to do that. Balls and strikes are pretty much the only thing that you can do it. And even then, I don't know enough about the technology, but how does a robo-ump adapt to different batting stances? Or Aaron Judge at 6'7" versus Jose Altuve at 5'7"? I don't know how these things are going to work. I guess they'll have it, based on the numbers for each player. But what if a guy changes his batting stance and crouches a little more? Or what? You know, it just there's going to be some imperfections no matter what system we use. I think, like I said, given the number of calls that are wrong, I think it's so minuscule compared to the number of calls that are right. And the number of times that you see a play with your naked eye and you say, oh, my God, he was safe. And then you see the replay and you're like, oh, you know, that was actually a pretty good call. He was out. That happens more than not to me. And I think to a lot of people. So, you know what? People like to complain about umps because sometimes that's all you have to complain about.
Last question for me. Rob Manfred was at the Sportico. It was an online sports conference. Was speaking at it earlier this week. And he had kind of an interesting comment talking about a discussion he had with Adam Silver. And Adam Silver said to him, I don't know why you keep pounding on and on and on about pace of play, because with legalized gambling coming in, the stoppages in baseball make it perfect for prop bets and for things like that. And it's the same thing we see in cricket. There's a reason cricket gets bet on a lot around the world. Well, because there's lots of stoppages in play. You can bet in the next toss if you want. Do you think that was just Rob kind of telling a story? Or do you think that maybe as baseball really does take a look, Mark, at establishing really strong formal ties with legalized gambling, that we may actually see a gradual pulling back of quote-unquote pace of play rules?
You know, it's a good question. I don't think there's going to be a pulling back on the pace of play rules because, you know, the people that you're trying to get into the game, the kids, the youth of our country, it's right. They're not gambling. They're not legally gambling, I should say. They can't go onto a sports book on their phone, without their parents' permission anyway, and place bets. So you're not going to get kids to watch games because they can gamble in between innings or in between pitches. And you are trying to attract kids and young people to watch this game and sort of start to formulate your next generation of fans. So I'm not sure. I think it'd be a nice bonus for those people who do indulge in legalized gambling to have those. But I think, look, if you're into legalized gambling, you're going to find a way to put your bet down one way or another, right? I mean, you're used to the high pace, sort of quick, okay, I got to get this betted now, in-game betting, whatever it may be. That's already there. I think the pace of play thing is an issue for TV, for young people. Young people, I mean, I've got a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old. They like fast-paced stuff. They like the NBA because there's always action. They like, they like the NFL because it's fantasy football and you know, they spend half the game looking at their phones on fantasy. So, you know, MLB needs to try to get some of those fans involved. And I think, you know, hastening the pace of play will certainly help move that in that direction.
Mark, good stuff, my friend. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
Take care. Mark Feinstein is executive reporter with MLB.com. We will take a look back. I shouldn't say take a look back. We'll take a look ahead to the Jays' next series against the Atlanta Braves. They have today off. The Braves are in town for three games starting tomorrow. And we'll talk with the Blue Jays about what the Blue Jays' pitching options may be over these next couple of days. This is Baseball Central. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Reminder, as always, you can reach out to us. 590-590 is the text line. Mr. Barker, Dan in the Hammer. I know that Charlie is well known for being overly optimistic, but it really felt to me last night like he missed an opportunity to get out there and show the team that he had Matz's back on that brutal missed third strike. I'm not saying that they need him to be a loose cannon, but that was brutal, and he sat by and watched Matz get hung out to dry. That from Dan in Hamilton. First of all, Dan, that wouldn't have changed the call. And I really, to this day, don't know. I mean, baseball's not football. It's not the try harder league. I don't think if Charlie goes out there and argues and everybody gets ginned up, that's still not going to allow Kevin Biggio to handle the high heater. It's just not. And I don't know. I tend to agree with Kevin here. I had an issue, I think, with how Danny Jansen called that game. I would like to see. I mean, Danny Jansen's been around enough. Now, there's no reason he can't call time and go out there and say, what the hell are we doing? Let's get in the same page here. He's been around. He's considered. The manager considers him to be a leader in the team. He's told him he wants to take more of a leadership role. But I think we get too wrapped up about managers showing fire and everything like that. I just want to know if it's going to have an impact. It's not going to change the umpire's strike zone if you go out.
I can't tell you how many times I've had managers come in after a game when a team's not doing one thing or the other and tip over a chair and throw a table or throw cups in the locker. Doesn't change the fact I can't hit a curveball. That doesn't change the fact that Steven Matz yesterday wasn't going to throw his sinker more than he threw his secondary pitches. It's a very individual thing. Maybe Charlie had enough of seeing it. Maybe the first six pitches he saw against Victor that were probably not pitches that should have been thrown, maybe that would have set him off a little bit, and it was more about a just tired of seeing the kind of thing instead of trying to get a team fired up. The fired up part of it, I've never seen it work, and I've been around forever.
It is remarkable. It is remarkable, Kevin, how often a manager gets thrown out of the game. Yes, it's in reaction to something an umpire does or doesn't do, but it's usually the result of, one, his pitcher screwed up, or two, somebody else in his team screwed up. It really is true.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's I remember Jim Fregosi telling a great story about how, and I'm not going to say the name of the pitcher, it was on the mound. And he said, I was going to kill him. There was one of two things are going to happen. One, I was going to punch him in the dugout because I was so pissed off. The team had been in the middle of a losing streak. Or two, I was going to get thrown out. So he went out and got thrown out. And he was yelling at the umpire, throw me out, throw me out. Yeah. Look at the pile of poop on the mound. Throw me out, throw me out.
Yeah.
That's a Jim Fregosi story for you. But yeah, I think a lot of times a manager's reaction, what sets a manager off is something his team is doing. And, maybe guys go out there to blow a gasket, to scare the hell out of their team. But I don't think a manager going out and ripping into an umpire does anything for the team.
No,
I don't think it does.
I've seen pitching coaches drag the on-deck circle up to home plate. And I thought that was more funny than anything.
Teddy Power?
Yeah, it was awesome. And he's got two fake hips. So you can imagine a guy with two fake hips trying to drag a... Jesus. It took him like 7 minutes to do it. It's hilarious.
Very quickly, as we look ahead to the pitching, I know we've only got a few minutes left here. Robbie Ray, we think right now, do we? Robbie Ray bullpen, maybe Stripling against the Braves.
Yeah. And then Matz, and then you would probably be looking at Nate Pearson. That Monday or that Tuesday in Oakland. Yeah, the second game in Oakland, I would assume. That's his
you
day.
You need somebody
the
in the fifth. And Ryu is due back on the 6th.
On the 6th, right? Yeah, it seems like that. But you would think the bullpen day is going to start with an opener. I don't think you could start Trent Thornton against Acuña Jr. and Freddie Freeman right out the gate. That's not very smart. So you may see an Anthony Castro, a Pye Amps, somebody that's not high leverage, especially when Jordan Romano looked like Jordan Romano yesterday. That makes that back into the bullpen all of a sudden a little, you know, three guys now can end it for you.
Wanted to ask you about that. Jordan Romano, 99 last night.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you're hearing rumblings of when he was in Tampa, they're trying to make him quicker to the plate, which just make you want to.
Why?
That's a great question. You know, Ben Wagner, I think, on the telecast yesterday was saying he was a 1-7. That's why they were stealing bases off of him. They wanted him to be 1-4.
Get the guy out. All of a sudden, this team's starting to worry about guys stealing bases.
How many highest leverage guys do you know how to hold a runner on?
Oh, Jesus. If you're worried about stealing bases, there's a lot of guys you can start with.
99 with an 88-mile-an-hour slider ain't bad.
We got lots to talk about. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll take a deep, deep, deep dive into the Braves. Going to be a lot of fun. Ronald Acuña Jr. against Vladdy Jr. Oh, it's going to be such a good weekend of baseball. We'll talk about it. Writer's Block is next.